This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Singer, guitarist, and songwriter Alex Chilton died Wednesday of an apparent heart attack. He was 59 years old. Alex Chilton first tasted fame as the lead singer of a 1960s group called the Box Tops. Their hits included Cry Like a Baby and The Letter, for which he provided the growly vocal when he was only 16 years old.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't live without me no more. Listen, mister, can't you see I got to get back to my baby once more? Anyway, yeah, give me a ticket for an aeroplane.
In the 1970s, Alex Chilton formed his own band, Big Star, which was less successful commercially, but regarded very warmly by critics and fellow artists, and was quite influential. At the time, Village Voice rock critic Robert Christgau described Chilton's Big Star music as breathtakingly original. In 2003, Rolling Stone magazine ranked all three Big Star albums on its list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. So revered was he by the next generation that The Replacements recorded a song called simply Alex Chilton. And Saturday night at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas, an event at which Alex Chilton had been scheduled to appear, original members of Big Star will join other musicians in a tribute to Alex Chilton. Those other musicians include members of REM, She and Him, and X. In remembrance of Alex Chilton, today we'll replay a pair of vintage interviews he recorded with Terry Gross, beginning with this one from 1991.
You started recording with the Box Tops when you were 16. Can you tell me how you got a chance like that at such a young age?
Well, Memphis was a hotbed of recording activity, Memphis, where I grew up. And, I was asked to join a kind of successful local band who made records at sort of a successful independent producer's studio. And after I'd been with them about a month, we went in the studio and recorded our first hit song. And so it was just something that was easy to fall into. It was sort of like growing up in Hollywood next door to MGM's studio lot or something, you know?
Right. Now, on those early sessions with the Box Tops, you have this real, you know, kind of rough, growly kind of voice. And your voice is completely different on your subsequent work. Did you sing that way at the time, or were you asked to sing that way?
Well, the producer of the band was a strong influence on how we sounded, and he would sort of demonstrate to me how he wanted things sung, and I would pretty much just imitate his singing. His name was Dan Penn, still is Dan Penn.
So did you feel like it wasn't really you on the records in that respect?
In a way, I do. I listen to it and I go, wow, Dan's really in voice today. It sounds more like Dan than it does myself to me.
What was it like handling fame at the age of 16? Were you prepared for it?
Oh, I mean, I don't know that anybody's prepared to handle fame. But then again, I think it would have made a lot more difference if I'd been a true believer in my own fame, too. But as it was, you know, we were kind of doing the bidding of producers and recording songs that were not our own, and it was sort of a job to me. I wasn't such a great fan of our group that I was really caught up in thinking that I was a tremendous great artist or anything at the time.
When did you leave the Box Tops and start your own group?
In 1970, I left the Box Tops, and I guess the next year I started the group called Big Star.
Now, let me ask you about one of the first records that you made on your own after the Box Tops, and this is a song you wrote called Free Again. Do you want to say anything about what was going through your mind when you wrote the song?
Sure. You know, I guess that it's some kind of tune of some kind of liberation as far as the lyrics. But I was a big fan of the Flying Burrito Brothers at the time, and you know, country rock was sort of something I was getting interested in. So it sounds very country rocky, and you know, with the pedal steel guitar and all.
Let's hear it. When you formed the band Big Star, was there an intended irony behind the name?
I guess so. We'd been together for some time without a name, and somehow there was a store across the street called the Big Star, and while wondering what we should call ourselves, we looked across the street, and somehow it seemed perfect. So I guess, yeah, there was an irony in calling our first album number one record by a group called Big Star. I guess we thought it was funny at the time.
Yeah, well, I guess it kind of stayed funny in the sense that never...
That we never sold any records.
Yeah. Was that a great disappointment to you?
I don't know. I wasn't really counting on selling a whole lot of records or anything, you know. I mean, I thought that someday if we ever sold any records, I might make some money out of it. That myth has been exploded for me also, but, you know, I didn't have any great emotional investment in the success or failure of the record in commercial terms.
Yeah, choose one of the songs from the early sessions that really still works for you, you know what I mean, that really sums up for you the kind of sound you wanted to get.
Well, my favorite song from the first Big Star record is called In the Street, you know, and I think that that's sort of the best song that I wrote in that period, and somehow it just turned out great, you know, on tape. These things happen sometimes for no good reason.
Let's hear it. Your records ended up being very influential to a lot of bands who were coming up at the time. The Replacements even have a song called Alex Chilton. When did you get a sense of the impact that your music was having on other musicians, even if it wasn't having a big impact commercially?
I guess in the late 70s, I spent some time in New York, and it seemed like everybody I ran into there, you know, claimed to be a fan of the Big Star albums and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I guess it was around then that I began to see that even though we hadn't sold any records or made any money out of the albums, that they were still some kind of success in a way, you know.
What would they tell you? What kind of specific stories did people tell you about the impact your music had on them?
Mostly what it is young guys coming up who are like learning to play guitar, you know. They seem to reach a certain stage where this record shows them something, you know. It's that I think that's what people go for about it. That's what they all seem to gravitate toward, is this jangly guitar sound that's happening there.
A lot of people call your music one of the first albums of power pop. What does that expression mean to you?
I don't know, really. I mean, to me, we were more like, our band was more like the mid-60s British invasion music. You know, it was like three-minute pop songs that were kind of unpretentious and very basically about love and just being a teenager and having a good time. You know, for me, music, once it entered the psychedelic era there in the 60s, I became less interested in it. I like simple pop songs with no real message, you know, just about feeling good and being happy.
Alex Chilton speaking to Terry Gross in 1991. Chilton made a return visit to Fresh Air in 2000 and brought his guitar with him. This was after his song In the Street had been used as the theme song for TV's That 70s Show, performed by Cheap Trick. Terry asked Alex Chilton how that song came to be chosen.
A friend of mine from Philadelphia, or at least from right across the river, named Ben Vaughn, has been working in Hollywood doing music for various media productions, television, I guess, and movies for the past few years. And he somehow is working with the people who produced the show, The 70s Show. And they were looking for a theme, and he suggested this tune to them, and I guess that they liked it and thought it would work well. So that's how it happened.
Did you write it in the 70s?
I did, yeah.
And does the song say 70s to you?
I never thought about it actually as having to do with a period of time. I thought of it as having to do with sort of growing up suburban and being a teenager, more or less.
Would you play some of it for us?
Yeah, I'll play some of it for you.
Hanging out down the street, the same old thing we did last week. Not a thing to do but talk to you. Steal your car and bring it down. Pick me up. Drive around. Wish we had a joint so bad.
So how old were you when you wrote that?
I guess I was 19 or 20.
So you weren't far removed from the character in the song.
True, true.
Smoking joints?
Of course.
The lyric is kind of rewritten for the TV show. I think there's nothing about the joint on it. And instead, there are lyrics about Nixon's gone, but rock lives on.
Oh, really? You know, I've never watched the show. I've never heard them do it.
Well, at least that's on the CD version of the theme from the show. I'm not sure that it's actually on the TV version.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about them changing your lyric?
Oh, I don't care what they do.
Uh-huh. I guess you never really know what's going to happen to one of your songs.
Yeah, people can twist it any kind of way they want, I guess.
But, I mean, you never know, like, what use it's going to have.
That's true.
Yeah. Let me take...
I don't feel like it's a real desecration, though. You know, it's not a sacred object.
Right.
Alex Chilton speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. Let's conclude our salute to Alex Chilton by hearing more from Terry's 1991 interview with him, when she asked about whether he ever performed music from the earliest part of his career.
Are you ever on the oldies circuit playing?
Absolutely, yeah.
You are?
Yeah, I played a gig with the Beach Boys a couple of weeks ago. That was thrilling. I got to even sing Surfin' USA on stage with them. It was the greatest thrill of my career.
So what's it like for you on the oldie circuit? Tell me what you like and dislike about it.
Well, I enjoy meeting all these bands that that I've heard of for so long. You know, like I've played some gigs lately with Question Mark from Question Mark and the Mysterians, and he's a lot of fun. It's interesting to be, you know, hanging around hotel lobbies with Question Mark and that sort of stuff. So, you know, in the summer times, it seems like people offer me some gigs, you know, with 60s bands and things like that. And it's fun to do now and then.
So what do you play?
Well, it's pretty strictly box tops material that's called for. And usually it's a five-song set, you know. So it's kind of easy money. You just get up and play five or six tunes at a county fair in Iowa or North Dakota or something, and it's kicky, you know. What can I say?
In the late 70s, you started becoming really part of the punk scene, and you produced records by the Cramps. You produced their first records. What attracted you to that? You'd already been around a while, and a lot of people in it were just coming up.
I don't know, everybody since the 60s, it seems like everybody who was still interested in playing rock and roll kept looking for, well, where is the new scene going to be? You know, we've got to have a scene going here so that we can all get involved in it and do good things. And I think that in New York in the mid-70s was the nearest thing to a scene like the London scene or the Los Angeles scene in the 60s, you know. So I sort of gravitated to it because there was an anarchistic sort of edge to it, and it wasn't some corporate showcase of Stepford Wives bands, you know, playing up there. It was real rebellious, good rock and roll that was coming from street level rather than corporate boardroom level.
You've been so influential on so many people in rock, and yet, you know, you're kind of functioning independently. You don't have a record contract. There isn't a big company after you to record something now. What explanation do you have for... I'm always interested when someone of your talents is kind of not more sought after.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It seems to me that the world is full of great musicians who don't have any record companies interested in them. It seems to me that the record companies are interested in bands of teenage guys, you know, with long hair and playing heavy metal music or whatever the next trend will be, you know, and... I'm not really so concerned about it. I mean, I've sort of got my scene going and have carved out a little niche, however little it is, in the music business, you know, and I manage to play as many gigs as I want every year and make money doing that and make a little money here and there making records, and it's okay with me.
What is that scene?
What is the niche that I've carved out, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I can play in these college towns and get my records played on college radio and that sort of stuff.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Singer-songwriter-guitarist Alex Chilton speaking to Terry Gross in 1991. The singer for the Box Tops and founder of the group Big Star died Wednesday of an apparent heart attack. He was 59 years old. He will be saluted in concert Saturday at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. You can hear Alex Chilton's complete interview with Terry Gross on May 1, 2000, on our website, freshair.npr.org. We'll close with a song Alex Chilton wrote and performed with Big Star. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Tell the girls, they said how much I was your blood.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the mid-70s, the idea of a sultry, defiant, all-girl rock band was considered outlandish. That changed with the Runaways, whose members included Joan Jett and Cherie Curry. The new film, The Runaways, based on Curry's memoir, tells the story of the group's rise and fall. It stars Kristen Stewart as Jett and Dakota Fanning as Curry. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The Runaways is a curious mix. It's an exhilarating story of female self-expression that's also a downbeat tale of female exploitation. So as the 70s girl group The Runaways comes together and then slowly disintegrates, there's a simultaneous rising and falling arc, which would be thrilling if writer-director Floria Sigismondi had a structure that could hold it all together. What she does have is punkish audacity. Her first shot is a splotch of menstrual blood on the pavement as 15-year-old future Runaways vocalist Cherie Curry gets her first period. What makes this even more outrageous is Cherie is Dakota Fanning, now stretched out and filled out. It's as if the director is saying, "Here's your adorable little child star. What do you make of her now? What will she make of herself?" After she's teased by her more worldly sister, Cherie dolls herself up and heads for well-known L.A. club Rodney Bingenheimer's English Disco, which is also where Kristen Stewart's Joan Jett heads after buying a black leather man's motorcycle jacket. She wants to play guitar in a rock band, but in the mid-70s, sexist conventional wisdom said girls didn't play electric guitar. But when Jett accosts the ghoulish impresario Kim Fowley, played by Michael Shannon, the idea for The Runaways is born.
I'm Joan Jett. I play guitar. Mm. Electric guitar.
Ooh. Joan Jett, that's a cool name. You guys got a demo?
No. No, I don't. No guys. I want to start an all-girl rock band.
Really?
Hey, Sandy.
Hold on, I'll be back.
Sandy West is a drummer. Joan Jett claims to be some sort of guitar goddess.
Well, I didn't say that.
That's a juicy scene, but a couple of things knock it down a peg. Kristen Stewart is overdoing the twitchy awkwardness. And then there's that usual biopic hazard, writing too on the nose, so that you almost see the light bulb over Fowley's head. Young girls, guitars, money. The Runaways is paced so fast that you barely register the externals before you're hurtled along to the next biopic marker. Although Jett is the co-executive producer and Stewart the first-billed star, the Jett character is mostly a bystander. She stands by as manager Fowley drills his girl band, then stands by some more as Curry becomes the group's blonde bombshell mascot and begins to fall apart from all the drugs and sex and Fowley abuse. Fowley isn't thinking female empowerment. He's thinking jailbait, barely pubescent girls acting dirty and available for an audience with as many people leering as rocking out. According to the documentary Edge Play, made by one-time Runaways member Vicky Tischler Blue, the vibe among the bandmates was never very good, and director Sigismondi gives scant time to other members. Late in the film, Curry and Jett have a love scene, but it happens in a vacuum. You get no sense if it altered the band's already volatile chemistry, or even what Jett and Curry made of it after the fact. The last part of the film is unfocused, with connective tissue missing. Maybe there's a 3-hour cut of The Runaways down the line that would be more compelling. As Fowley, Michael Shannon looks scary and stops the show with his rants. But have you ever seen the real Fowley interviewed? His creepiness is otherworldly. Shannon, even with his formidable size and nonstop epithets, seems too lovably damaged. This is Fanning's movie, and you can taste her relish in breaking out of child stardom with a vengeance. But as she parades around on stage, half-naked, chanting she's a cherry bomb and striking one sexual pose after another, you're uncomfortably aware that she's 15 years old and legally a minor. How we reconcile that fact, or can't, with the thrill of her performance, gives the Runaways at least some of the present tense electricity that the real group had on stage so long ago.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Before getting the starring role in the AMC drama Breaking Bad, the actor Bryan Cranston was best known as Hal, the childlike father on Malcolm in the Middle. You might also have known him as Jerry's dentist on Seinfeld, as Agent Stan Grossman in Little Miss Sunshine, or as a guy with a severe headache problem on The X-Files. But as high school science teacher Walter White, Bryan Cranston has won back-to-back Emmy Awards as Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series. So he's definitely arrived. And Season 3 of Breaking Bad arrives this Sunday, picking up where last season's cliffhanger left off. In Breaking Bad, created by Vince Gilligan, we first met Cranston's Walter when his wife was pregnant and he was diagnosed as having terminal lung cancer. To provide for his family, Walter decided to utilize his knowledge of chemistry to manufacture crystal meth and team up with a former student, played by Aaron Paul, to sell it. Since Walter made that decision, almost nothing has gone right. And while Walter thinks he's succeeded in keeping his dark secret from his wife, maybe he hasn't. In Sunday's new episode, she suddenly hands him some divorce papers.
Why are you doing this? Why are you even thinking this way? Is it to punish me?
I am not punishing you, Walt.
This is punitive, is what this is. We are happily married. I am happily married. I am happy. We're just... I love you, Skylar. And I would do anything for you. Would you even consider... I mean, Jesus! You come in here and you wave these papers in my face when there's a whole other... entire side to this thing. There's your side and there's my side, and you haven't heard my side yet. You haven't heard any of it at all.
You're a drug dealer.
No, what? How? What?
Yeah. How else could you possibly make that kind of money?
I spoke to Bryan Cranston in 2008, right after the premiere of Breaking Bad. Bryan Cranston, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
I have to be honest, Bryan, when I heard the premise for this series, I didn't think I'd like the character or the show very much. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about crystal meth, we're talking about cancer. But you really pulled me in. I still wasn't sure when the hour was over what to think of this guy. And I'm wondering, is that the only script that you saw when you had to decide whether to accept the part or not?
Yes, the only thing I saw was the pilot script. And as an actor, you know, if it starts to seep into your soul and you start daydreaming about the character and having nighttime dreams about the character, then it's becoming you, or you're becoming it, one way or the other. And when I had my first meeting with Vince a year and a half ago, I couldn't help but start saying exactly what I felt about him. This is, I think he should be a little pudgy. I think he should be pale. I think he should be colorless. I think his clothes should be this way. I think he should have this silly mustache that doesn't really convey anything except that it conveys impotence to me. It was unnecessary. And it sort of was a manifestation of what I thought his life was like at that time. Basically unnecessary, that he felt useless. Invisible to the world, to society, even to himself.
A question about a very dramatic scene, which is where you're deciding or confronted with the decision of whether or not to undergo chemotherapy treatments. And your wife stages a sort of intervention and everyone's around and you take turns talking by holding a talking pillow, which gives you the right to speak. And it's a funny idea in a very dramatic scene, and you're the last to speak, and finally you get the talking pillow. And I thought, this is the first time you've had the talking pillow in 4 or 5 episodes. And how hard a scene was that for you to do, because you were quite strong in it?
The thing about an actor approaching a scene like that is you can't for a second think that what you're doing is funny. Because if you do, then there's a slight wink, wink, nod, nod to the audience. Oh, isn't this cute? We're using this talking pillow. And all of us just took this idea that this gave us the right to speak at that time and to speak uninterrupted. And it's very respectful of the audience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a laugh track to it. And if the audience finds that piece funny, as you did, David, then I think you can smile or laugh if that strikes you that way or not. And ultimately, that is just so juicy to play because there's a whole wide range of reactions that an audience can have at any particular time, and none is wrong.
Your resume fascinates me. You seem to have been in the 70s and 80s in one episode of almost everything.
Mm.
Not several episodes, just one. But, I mean, mm-hmm. great shows like Chicago Hope and L.A. Law and 30-something and Hill Street. And then you're in Walker, Texas Ranger, Touched by an Angel, Jake and the Fat Man, and Baywatch.
Mm-hmm. Wide range of good programs and crappy ones.
That's sort of my question. But I mean,
yeah.
Clearly a working
actor. Oh,
don't
be embarrassed.
But how – and your first job is like on Chips, bless your
uh-huh.
soul. So first of all, how do you get started on Chips? And then how do you balance this career?
Well, when an actor first starts out, you're looking to work, any work. You need money to pay your rent and money to pay for your 8x10 pictures and your resumes and your acting classes. So you need some film on yourself, and that's you're willing to take just about anything. Yeah.
But what do you remember about Chips?
I remember I had this terrible Southern accent. I think I was talking like this. I was talking like a – and I had a wife on the show named Kathy Schauer who was apparently – and I didn't really know it at the time. She was a very pretty woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Playboy playmate and was like, wow, Eric Estrada. That's all he had to find out. Playboy playmate. And, he was after her like nobody's business. And it's like – you know, it's interesting because I heard nothing but bad things about Eric, things saying, oh, he does this, he does this, he's, you know. And he was nice to me on the show, I must say.
Well, another bad TV show. I mean, I've been a TV critic since 75, so I can say this.
Oh.
Another bad show you were on, but it had a good result for you, was Airwolf. Wasn't that Jan Michael Vincent in a helicopter? Is that the one I'm thinking of, or am I confusing
that's
that?
Walking. Yeah, no, that's the one. Jan Michael Vincent on his descent into his personal hell, which was horrible. This guy was, had so much promise, and he was late every day, and he had, his drinking problem, his drug problem, and there was a scene where we're in a helicopter and they're shooting what's called a poor man's process, which is a helicopter is not actually in the air. But if you shoot from a low angle up, all you see is sky behind you, and there's a couple grips in the back moving the rotor, and it looks like the whole thing is in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And there was our first AD would say, okay, roll sound speed, here we go, slate it, and Brian, and he would shake his fist to me. That would be my cue to wake up Jan.
Oh.
And to have – no, to, seriously, to wake up Jan and have him, act in the scene. And it was such a shame, and I was like, God, this is so horrible, especially for a beginning actor when I was pretty new there and wanting more than anything to be able to be a part of the acting community and to have the gift that has eventually came to me to become a good working actor. And I don't take it lightly, and I don't have any expectations of what – the business owes me. I have no sense of entitlement. I just work.
We're talking to Bryan Cranston, star of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. One thing that I find in common between your part of Hal in Malcolm in the Middle and your new part as Walter in Breaking Bad, and there isn't that much that they have in common, but it's as an actor, a total lack of vanity when it comes to attacking the characters as you see them. And I'd like to play the first scene from Malcolm in the Middle where we meet your character. You're the husband and you're down. The kids are at the breakfast table. They're trying to eat. You're nude reading a newspaper that's strategically open to cover things while you're reading mm-hmm. it, and your wife, Jane Kaczmarek, is shaving your back hair with some hair trimmers.
Huh. Look at this. They're sending an unmanned probe to Venus and letting a bunch of school children name it. Well, that's gonna end badly.
These clippers are dull already. Honestly, Hal, you're like a monkey.
They do this every month. He has sensitive skin. The hair gets itchy under his clothes.
Yeah, it seems like such a shame to just dump this in the trash. Maybe birds would like to make nests with it, or, I don't know, maybe you boys could use it for school projects. Arms up.
So, that's, what memories does that bring back to you? And is it true that you had to have, for your first scene in a sitcom, or the first scene, maybe they were shot out of sequence, but you had to have yak hair glued all over you to make that scene
yes.
work?
I have nothing but fond memories of Malcolm in the Middle. It was a fantastic period of my life. Brilliantly written by Linwood Boomer. That was the first scene. The first scene I ever shot in the pilot was the scene where I'm naked in front of all these children. And the person who's in charge of kids, you know, in taking care of them from the Coogan Law, and they have all these rights, which is fantastic now, insisted that in between scenes, I stand behind this black curtain. So apparently, while we're shooting it, my nudity was okay and didn't hurt the retinas of their little eyes. But in between, I had to go stand behind this curtain. But yes, it's true. I was, except for a modesty patch, and believe me, it was very modest, I had nothing else on. It took three makeup artists 4 hours to apply yak hair to my body. And they said it was yak hair, and they told me why. Yak hair most resembles human hair, but it's longer. So they were able to use part of it for the glue and still have part of it that is unmatted and standing out. But that meant I couldn't sit down. So for the entire day that we're shooting this, I never sat down. And I had my arms out most of the time so everything wouldn't get matted. But when it came time to actually shaving this hair off my body, the glue would get stuck in the razor and it would start to pull my skin. So we had to have a casting call for hairy back people. And they brought in all kinds of people. It looked like a carpeteria store where there was Shag and there was Lopile and there was, you know, Berber. And they picked the body type that they felt was most like mine, which is very unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And they had a body double, and it turned out to be one of our Teamster guys.
We're talking with Bryan Cranston, star of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. One of the things I learned reading about you for this is that your parents were actors, Joe and Peggy Cranston. Would I know them from anything?
You wouldn't know my mom, and my dad might be hard to remember. I remember when my dad was, he had the real actor's life. His life was up and down and up and down. And I remember him mostly dying in everything that I saw him do. From the, whether he was a soldier on top of the roof in the day that was it not the were the end of the world, I forget what the name of the movie was, the sci-fi movie with the large grasshoppers that took over the city. He was in that saying, you know, Sector 8 is fine here. And we see him die, you know, or else he was an infantry man, or he was in the cavalry and he got shot with an arrow. He was always dying. Hey, Dad's dying tonight, you know. So we'd watch him, but he met my mother in the late 40s in an acting class in Hollywood, and he was they were all in the same class with Anne Bancroft and David Janssen at the time, and it was kind of a good time for them, and post war and everything was kind of on the upswing, and they married and decided to have children, and that's when my mom decided, well, I'll either have a career or be a mother, and those were the choices for women in those days, and she always regretted that. She always wished that she had pursued both.
Bryan Cranston, it was a joy having you on Fresh Air. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Actor Bryan Cranston interviewed in 2008. He's since won back-to-back Emmy Awards for Breaking Bad. The show's third season begins Sunday night on AMC. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, the TV critic here. It's an exciting season for cable TV, which at this moment is a lot more competitive and interesting than broadcast network television. The AMC series Breaking Bad is back for its third season Sunday, and Showtime's Nurse Jackie and the United States of Tara are back to start their sophomore seasons on Monday. I'll get to them in a minute. But first, a few words about Life, the highly promoted and eagerly anticipated nonfiction nature miniseries that begins Sunday on Discovery Channel. Life is being promoted as a follow-up to Planet Earth, the fabulous nature miniseries that also was co-produced by Discovery Channel and the BBC. And visually, it's every bit as mesmerizing and satisfying. You find yourself in awe of two things simultaneously: the events taking place in the animal kingdom and the manner in which the camera crews were able to capture them. Just as in Planet Earth, Life contains some killer footage, sometimes literally. You get to watch Komodo dragons team up to bring down a much larger water buffalo, and humpback whales jockey and fight to be in position to impress a lone female. From the tiniest frogs to the largest mammals, Life captures one fascinating creature and activity after another, and definitely qualifies as must-see television. But there's a big but. Life is not produced and directed by the same people who masterminded Planet Earth, though some producers of separate segments are involved. And the major difference between Planet Earth and Life is that Planet Earth was written at a higher level, assuming more intelligence on the part of the viewer. Planet Earth talked to us. Life tends to talk down to us, and it's annoying. So is Discovery Channel's decision, once again, to substitute the original narration by Sir David Attenborough, the most reputable nature TV expert on the planet. With Planet Earth, Sigourney Weaver replaced the original narration. This time, it's Oprah Winfrey. And while Oprah Winfrey may be the queen of all media, one of her strengths is not being a captivating narrator. Add to it the simplicity of the writing, and while Life looks great, parts of it, like this closing minute of Sunday's installment on amphibians and reptiles, sound like the nature documentary equivalent of the closing narration to Desperate Housewives.
It isn't easy to love an amphibian or a reptile. Most modern humans seem to have an innate aversion to them. They inhabit places we would rather not go. Their ways are alien to us. But in the end, they are driven by the same forces to which all animal life must answer: the need to eat, the need to pass on their genes, the need to defend themselves. And in this, they are among the most brilliant of evolutionary improvisers. Hard to kill, tenacious, and supremely adaptable. Improbable geniuses of survival.
My advice regarding this new look at Life? Wait for the DVD with Attenborough, or watch now with slightly lowered expectations. Either way, it really is a TV show to behold. The same goes for the three scripted series returning for new seasons. All three have enhanced the reputations of their respective networks, and all three are about deeply flawed yet almost hypnotically fascinating characters. Breaking Bad, which returns Sunday on AMC, picks up right where last season ended, with a spectacular, unexpected tragedy. All the characters are trying to cope, but in different ways, and the only thing predictable about this series is its unpredictability. After only two seasons, Breaking Bad has established itself as one of TV's very best drama series. And I promise you, if you tune in for the wordless opening scene, you'll be hooked for the duration. Breaking Bad stars Bryan Cranston as Walter White, a high school science teacher turned crystal meth manufacturer. Not a character with whom you'd normally empathize. The same goes for the lead roles in Showtime's United States of Tara and Nurse Jackie, which begin their new seasons Monday. Edie Falco from The Sopranos stars in Nurse Jackie, playing a registered nurse with a family, an ex-lover, and a drug habit. Toni Collette in The United States of Tara plays several leading roles, all fractured parts of the same struggling personality. All three of these stars, Cranston, Falco, and Collette, commit so highly to their roles that they not only win our sympathy, they disappear within the parts they're playing. When an episode is over, I usually feel bad for Jackie or Tara or Walter. Only afterward does it sink in just how wonderful a performance and a show I've just witnessed. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.